Joe Courtney, you're the congressman from where we make our submarines in Connecticut. So I guess the question I wanted to ask you was, why do we need submarines?
Well, I would say that if you look at the analysis that's been done in terms of sort of, you know, emerging threats and activity that's going on out there in the world today, you know, what we're seeing is, number one, you know, the South China Sea, which is, you know, been a peaceful area of transit for, you know, countries and ships from all over the world. About $5 trillion of goods pass through there every year to different parts of the globe. I think part of that is because we have a strong Navy, the U.S. Navy, that, you know, really views its role as, you know, protecting the commons of the sea, as they call it. And that is now, I think, really very much in doubt because we see a Chinese government and Navy that is trying to militarize the South China Sea. They have invested heavily in the size of their fleet. I mean, actually, numerically, if you look at it, they have more submarines than the U.S., and we have a submarine fleet that, you know, is deployed in other parts of the world, not just Asia-Pacific. And they, as the New York Times did a couple of stories recently, are, you know, acting as if any ship that passes through that part of the world is really subject to their permission and their approval, even though it, you know, that, if you look in the maps, it is far outside the international recognized waters of a country like China. Again, the Sodaku Islands, the Spratly Islands, you know, all of these areas where they're building atolls and constructing landing strips and bringing warships to tie up. You know, this is totally outside the United Nations Convention Law of the Sea, the UNCLOS Treaty, as it's called. And there's no question that, you know, our fleet size, our submarine fleet size, which at the end of the Cold War was at about 100 submarines and now is at 52 and is going to continue to shrink as the sort of legacy ship construction from the 80s continues to time out. I mean, these ships are old and they're just, you know, are no longer usable. And that's one of the reasons why the decline that's taken place. You know, I think a measured response to that, assuming, you know, people agree that we ought to have a Navy, is to have a two-a-year build rate, which is what we've seen happen since I've been in Congress. I came in, they were only building one a year. We're now at two a year, and we're about to do an armed services bill, which is going to continue that two-a-year build rate. And that way, you know, you have what is clearly identified as the most valuable asset in the Navy in terms of being able to avoid any of the sort of aggressive maritime activity that we're seeing happening in Asia Pacific. At the same time, Putin is recapitalizing his Navy. We had testimony from Admiral James Stavridis, who's the dean of the Fletcher School of Diplomacy at Tufts University. He came before the committee a little while ago. He used to be the NATO commander, and he basically said that Russian submarine activity is now at about 80% of what it was during the Cold War. We're opening up a Navy base in Iceland to begin again the you know, patrols that existed back in the, you know, 70s and 80s. And not that we're in exactly the same place, but there's just no question that, you know, we're seeing an aggressive posture with Vladimir Putin and the Navy buildup that they're engaged in right now. It totally has completely caught our intelligence folks off guard. I mean, if you went back even just 3 or 4 years ago, none of them would have predicted the kind of aggressive attitude that's happening right now. I mean, we saw it, you know, just a couple days ago with that Russian fighter jet who, you know, buzzed the deck of the USS Cook, who, again, was totally within its rights to be, you know, at sea in the Baltic Ocean, the Baltic Sea. By the way, one thing that would help the cause from the U.S. standpoint is that we've never actually ratified the U.N. Law of the Sea Treaty, even though the Bush administration, the Clinton administration, both Bush administrations and the Obama administration have been all calling on the Senate to take up ratification of this treaty. We're one of the few countries in the world that hasn't done it. So what that means, actually, is the Philippines has filed a challenge to the Chinese behavior in South China Sea, and The Hague is where that gets litigated. The U.S. asked for observer status during the proceedings, but because the U.S. Senate has refused to take up UNCLOS, the Law of the Sea Treaty, we were refused even observer status in the court's proceedings, which is really, it's so inexcusable because, you know, this is going to guide really a lot of, you know, the maritime rules of the road out there, and thus will guide Navy budgets, Navy policy for many years to come. It is time for the U.S. to get past the groups that oppose that treaty, which is Heritage Action. I mean, it's the usual litany of super conservative groups who think that, you know, we're somehow giving up U.S. sovereignty by participating in a treaty that was actually negotiated by the Reagan and Bush administrations a long time ago. And I know that's a little bit of a obscure sidetrack here, but frankly, it's something that people who are very close to these issues, I mean, the U.S. Navy, the U.S. Coast Guard, they are all on record as strongly calling for the Senate to move forward and ratify that treaty.
Okay, Joe Courtney, we have some time left, but I want to give it to you to talk about why the House doesn't take up their budget, the budget for the United States. What's going on?
Again, I think after the little honeymoon that Speaker Ryan had, at the end of December, he's right back into the same predicament that Speaker Boehner was in, which is that he's got a wing of his party who is wants to go back on the two-year budget deal that we passed in December and basically gut a lot of these priorities that we thought we actually had a deal on. And, rather than trying to force a vote, again, if he came to us and said, I need your help to restore, the deal that was approved and signed into law back in December, he instead is trying to keep this within the family of the Republican caucus. And as long as he insists on that kind of approach, he's never going to get a budget resolution because it's just he's never going to find the votes to do that.
Well, we need a budget. I mean,
we sure do.
Is this the kind of thing which is not really recognized by voters? In other words, that we need this budget. What's the matter with you Republicans in the House? You won't bring it up. You won't get it done. What is this something that the American people need civics lessons on?
Well, it's certainly when we had the shutdown in 2013 in October for 17 days, that actually did break through all the white noise.
Right.
And I think, again, they paid for it in terms of the, every bit of, public opinion data that was out there. People's memories fade. And when you talk about it in the context of no budget, as opposed to a shutdown, it gets a little bit more sort of theoretical. Mm. But even though, as you point out, I mean, it isn't theoretical at all. It provides the underpinnings for government to function. And, I think, obviously, there's a lot of factors in terms of trying to figure out where the voters' heads are going to be at in November. But clearly, Senator Cruz, brings to the table, someone with a really pretty awful record of calling for this kind of obstructionism and disruption of regular order, which doesn't do anybody any good. It doesn't help people have to set state budgets or local budgets. It doesn't help businesses. It doesn't help the markets, in terms of their expectations of stability. And I do think that's a pretty unappealing sort of record to bring to the voters for somebody who wants to have the highest office in the land.
We have been talking to our friend Joe Courtney, Democrat, Connecticut, 2nd District. Joe, you're always terrific, and I just so appreciate your coming on and spending this time with us. I know how busy you are and how many people you have to see every day and how you have to vote and do all the rest of it, but we do appreciate it, and I want you to know it.
Well, I enjoy, the time I spend with you on 90.3. I got it wrong last time, so I want to make sure I got the call numbers right this time.
There are exactly 29 stations that are run by WAMC, so you could say 90.3. You'd probably make anything up, and it would probably be right. Thanks,
okay,
Joe. Appreciate
thanks,
it.
Thanks, Alan.